and welcome to a special series from the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be releasing four retrospectives of these amazing interviews that we did at Rocky Mountain Psych Association. And to accompany those are going to be this, which is a supercut of 2 to 3 interviews that we did. And so if you'd like to kind of listen to all of them at once and then listen to our retrospective, or listen to our retrospective, and then you're interested in listening to the episodes, well, here they are. If you are interested in it, listening to these episodes solo, just one, you want to, you know, download and listen to it, whatever. All the links are in the description below for all the separate ones. But we're going to be kind of going through a number of kind of clusters or collectives that kind of mesh together. And so, I hope you enjoy. And this is sort of a little intro as we kind of get into it. So with no further ado, enjoy these great interviews that we did at Rocky Mountain Psych Association 2023. Bye, everyone.
Alrighty, we're back at RMPA in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and with us is Andromeda Day. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
Would you like to give us an introduction about yourself and what you're doing here?
I'm an undergrad at New Mexico Highlands, and I'm here to talk about my poster presentation.
Sweet. And what'd you do? What's the research?
It's about gamification of Title IX Violence Against Women's Act and sexual education.
Sweet.
So basically, we rounded up a whole bunch of students, which were mostly athletes, and they took our Jeopardy-based survey.
Jeopardy-inspired.
Inspired survey after they played a Jeopardy game, and it seems like they had fun. They learned some. It was a bit sparse on where they learned from and what the main source they learned from. However, there was only not that many students, and so it was a bit spread out, and we didn't get through the whole Jeopardy game. So we may be doing that way, or having it done in a classroom, because if it's done in a classroom, your students will be more happy because they're doing a game in class.
Right, and they're a captive audience.
Mm-hmm. And they're not expecting to be entertained like at something like the midterm escape.
Right. So what did you find with the limited sample that you had?
They learned, like, there were specific things that they learned really well and specific things they did not understand at all.
Okay.
So, like, one was what age in New Mexico can an underage person and overage person actually have sex? And most of them said not at all.
Uh-huh.
When technically, if they are married, they can have sex.
Right.
Based on like the laws and stuff like that, because you could technically, I think it's 16 or 17 that you could technically get married here. So like things like that, where it's like technicalities and very specific details that they would remember, I think they had a lot more trouble remembering.
Do they have a tendency to remember like the more shocking information? So like less technicality and more like, ooh, like that's like,
yeah, like certain aspects, like they were just like, oh, that's shocking and like concerning, like that this many people like are sexually assaulted every year, like this many people don't go to the police for it and stuff like that. So that really popped out for them.
What you said there was a limited sample size. Can you walk me through the journey that you had to get the study going and run and collected data?
We started all the way back in
August.
We were supposed to do the first one in October. And it took all the way till what was this, February?
March.
March.
Oh, man.
All the way till March before we were finally able to be able to get a room and get some people in there to actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it even took like 45 minutes after we were supposed to originally start before people actually showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the cafeteria and shouted it saying, hey, come, we're doing this thing. You could get some gift cards. And eventually we got people. So I was just happy we got somebody in that room.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds about right for research. I'm just happy I got some people in a room.
Yep. So what would you, so through this process, what would you do differently next time? Or like, where does this research go in the future for you?
I'd like to see it be done in a classroom.
Okay.
I'd like to see like an actual class of high school, college students actually doing this and seeing where their knowledge is in a classroom. And I want to see what's, like colleges actually have Title IX training. And who mm-hmm. has to take said Title IX training? Because at Highlands, only RAs have to take Title IX training. Nobody else has to take Title IX training. Nobody else has to like have that in their face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's amongst the student. Oh, I'll preface this. That's amongst the student population.
Yeah.
Of the students.
Everyone who works there has to take this kind of training. But yeah, amongst students, it's very limited.
As a student employee, I didn't have to take it at all.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I only had to take like a basics of like privacy. Like if somebody left their computer open with their stuff on it, just close the computer. And that was it. That was the only type of training I had to do.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem that like with like universities needing to maintain these sort of like federal guidelines for something like Title IX, like basic information mm-hmm. to the wider student body would be like very helpful in maybe reducing incidents of stuff that's happening.
From what I understand, the undergrads who do get Title IX training, they just receive a like PowerPoint file.
And then do like a quiz in Brightspace, because that's how my training was for confidentiality. Yeah. But also, I didn't know very much about Title IX until I did this project.
Mm-hmm.
I knew like there was some law, but I didn't know what's Title IX.
Mm-hmm. No, we definitely learned. I learned more about Title IX through this research than I had in all my trainings.
Yeah, we still get a talk, but even then, it's like during Faculty Development Week, and it's limited.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not like a quiz. It's just sort of here's the stuff you guys have to. And it's mostly about first reporter. It's mostly about reporting,
right,
as opposed to like the law, because like there's a Title IX officer and the dean of students who really kind of, I guess, handle most of that. We just have to report to them.
Yeah, but with the quizzes, you could have the PowerPoint up
mm-hmm.
and take the quiz at the same time. So it's like you don't even have to memorize it. You could just have the quiz up, and I think you get unlimited time with it too. So you could just have it up with the PowerPoint presentation and just go over real quick, answer the questions, and be done with it.
There's no incentive to actually learn the material.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Cool.
So everyone should do a Jeopardy-inspired learning for some of the information.
At least some of the information. Like you should know at least the basics of what your rights are and what you could do for your rights.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
All right.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we're back here at RMPA on our sort of live podcast session, and we're here with Dr. Rachel Lamb and Stephanie Johnson to talk about the effect of tattoos on well-being. So we're gonna start with introductions. We'll let you guys introduce yourselves, and then we'll kind of get right into the research.
Okay, Rachel, go first. Rachel.
Yeah, go ahead, Stephanie. Let me let you go first.
Okay, fine. So my name is Stephanie Johnson. I studied psychology at Weber State in Ogden, Utah. I graduated just last December, so yeah.
Congratulations.
I'm taking a little bit of a break. But on top of that, I've also been tattooing almost 10 years. It'll be 10 years this December, so that's pretty exciting.
Cool.
So that's me.
Are you planning on going to grad school?
Yes, I am planning on going to grad school.
Excellent.
But which direction I'll go in, I have no idea.
Right on.
My name is Rachel Lamb, and I am now teaching faculty at Weber State University. I was in full-time research for about 5 years in Arizona, in Singapore, and in Switzerland. So my area is generally in learning and cognition. I actually love teaching and mentoring a lot more than I like doing my own research. So I am happy to be at Weber. Stephanie was a student in my research methods class that I just was really impressed with how she was thinking about what she wanted to do. And she had such a strong sense of how she could incorporate this part of her life as a tattoo artist into, you know, researching and looking at how the actual act of tattooing or, you know, body modification, things along those lines, could impact mental health. And of course, as we worked together, Stephanie went through my class, became one of my independent research students, which is part of the, you know, what she's presenting at the conference this week. Found some really cool stuff. Like our hypothesis was to, you know, that something about this actual act of being kind of in the process of enduring a tattoo or a body modification, it actually being in a physically painful process or something about that, that has an effect, a positive effect on well-being. So we looked at specifically kind of emotional states sort of in the moment, pre and post. And I'm just, you know, I'm thrilled for her to keep going and to get into grad school and to continue this work, because I think it's awesome. And I think it's really a niche area that not a lot has been done on in this particular way.
Very cool. Stephanie, would you like to walk us through the process of the research? So
yeah. So basically, like Rachel said, we did a pre and post survey. And in that survey, there were 20 emotions in which they could rank from 1 to 5. 1 being like, I'm not feeling this at all. And 5 being, I'm feeling this a lot. And then these 20 like subcategories were all filtered into 4 main emotions. So we had like joy, fear, sadness, and anger. Was it anger? I believe. No, joy, and I have to look at my notes and I don't have them. So we gave them identical surveys. So they would go in, fill it out, and then immediately after the tattoo, they would do the same survey. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool to find that not only did we have multiple areas of significance, there was actually a significant factor that we weren't looking at or even considered, and it was a difference in how men and women expressed joy in particular, that women had a higher, like an increased feeling of joy after a tattoo rather than the men, which was interesting for us, which is funny in comparison to our pilot study that I didn't talk about in my talk. We had a significant difference with how men perceived themselves after a tattoo. Which is something we could go into and something that you actually had asked me about.
Yeah, well, I'll ask you that now because I said I'll wait. And so what I had asked was my partner, I was telling her about this research and some of the interviews that we were doing, and she got really excited because she has several tattoos, and I said that I'm too afraid to get a tattoo. Me and Needles don't get along. But she said that afterwards, one of the things that she experienced was this kind of heightened sense of empowerment. And so I had this kind of question looking at your results as to whether or not maybe some of that difference was from the men. Maybe it's while still potentially stigmatized, it's not as stigmatized as women getting tattoos. And so by kind of going through that act, there's that further sense of empowerment for women, which would increase that post-tattoo joy as opposed to the men who may not, it may be muted in that way because it's like, yeah, I can get a tattoo, like whatever, I'm gonna go about my life.
So the way I'm going to answer this question is actually kind of opposite than I think how you're expecting it to be answered.
That's great.
And I could be wrong, and Rachel could jump in and be like,
No, I would love to respond as well. Yeah, I would love to respond, and I want to let you talk first, Stephanie.
So in the 10 years I've been doing tattoos, and I'm going to mention that a lot because I've learned so much over these 10 years. It's impacted my entire life. I found that in Western culture, I feel like there's no space for men to become men. So what I have found is, like, for women, and, like, I don't know what we can say on this podcast, but for women,
whatever you
like,
want.
Whatever you
okay,
want.
Okay, so, like, women, you're a girl, and then you have your period, and now you're a woman. Okay, so there's, like, our cutoff date. We're a woman now, and we know all the implications that come with that. Mm-hmm. But for men, I don't think there is one, mm-hmm. specifically in Western culture. And so it's something that, like, I think they kind of, men in particular, kind of are more relaxed about getting a tattoo because they think it's something that it's just, like, something that people do. But so many men that I've seen have used this from a transition of, like, this was a really hard point in my life, and I'm now becoming a man.
It's like a rite of passage.
Yeah, so it's a rite of passage for them, at least from what I've experienced. So it's something that I think maybe doing another study on in that area I would love to do because I don't have a ton of male clients. My work is very feminine. You know, it's not super masculine, but I work alongside with male artists that have a lot of male clients. So I would love to study their clients and be like, okay, well, like, what is this for you? What is this meaning for you? And a lot of the men that I talk to, they do come in during really, really hard points in their life. And so it's interesting, like, you know, with the women having more joy, I don't see that as much being like a factor in which they're getting tattooed. So maybe they're able to express that joy more freely. And it could just be like men have a hard time expressing their emotions. And it's really hard. It was so hard to get men to be like, how are you feeling?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think, you know, there's so many factors we can look into it. But I do think that in our culture and, you know, Western society, we don't really have like a cutoff point and we don't have anything to celebrate what it is to be a man or it is to like celebrate manhood as we do women. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah, that there's that like kind of shared sense of identity becomes very nebulous when mm-hmm. you don't have, again, that like culturally defined event that moves you into that.
And it's interesting because it's for women, it's so physical.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, men bulk up, they get taller, all that stuff, but so do women, you know.
Right.
We bulk up, we get taller, but we also have, like, more pronounced physical changes, plus one that's like, oh, this is like, mm-hmm. you know, I am now capable of reproducing. And in society, that's something that's really, like, oh, this is important. Mm-hmm. You're now a woman, you need to protect yourself, you know. And for men, there's just, I am so hurt for men because I feel like that's been robbed of them. From this transition to boyhood to manhood. What do you think on it, Rachel?
Yeah, no, this is good. This is good stuff. Actually, I can comment and kind of maybe tie in together all of what was said here. So I can see certainly what you're saying, Stephanie, especially maybe in the last 30 years, the role of a man is changing in society. And there's certainly, you know, there's the whole movement of feminism and things has brought, you know, it's still not equal. I hope we all know that, but it's brought women kind of more into power positions. It's brought more women into leadership. So when you talk about kind of men not really having that rite of passage, like women have such a natural sort of rite of passage, even in Western society, men don't really have that. So part of me wonders, just the mutedness of their emotional states changing might be a thing. If you're, you know, kind of coming to get a tattoo, and Stephanie and I have talked a lot about this. People, you know, have meaning attached to their tattoos a lot of the time. It's something, it's a commemorative thing for a tragedy that's happened, or a memorial, or a great thing in their life. You know, they might celebrate by going to get a tattoo. I wonder if one of the differences for men is just that, one, they're not encouraged to be highly emotional. So that could be part of a mutedness and seeing kind of like a different increase in something like joy. And perhaps there's just a general state that men might find themselves in. And of course, this is a very niche population of people, right? So I'm sort of generalizing within the population of men that'll go get tattoos, let's say. Maybe there's just a different kind of way the power of a tattoo is seen for men. And so that joy might be lessened. And then on the flip side of that, for a woman, you know, historically, like women still to this day, right? A woman with visible tattoos is looked at a certain way. And you know, I think it's changing. But people make assumptions about women with tattoos that aren't the same as the assumptions about men with tattoos, right? Mm-hmm. So I am also a person with tattoos. I've got pretty big tattoos, but they're all pretty hidden. So I did that purposely because I was in a professional world for a little while. But I love them. I love using them as art on my body to signify different things and meaningful things. But I've always been careful in my past to not have them too visible because of the judgments that I receive as a woman with tattoos in the spaces that I've been in. So I think when a woman makes a decision to go and get, you know, tattoos done, it is something empowering. I think you're right on that when you said there's something maybe that's more empowering for a woman to get this visible thing that's a little bit taboo still in our society and kind of make that statement like, hey, you know, I'm going to show this and I'm not afraid of it. And I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not afraid to show who I am. And that is something like in my mind that is quite empowering. And so I wonder how much of that has come into play just with the work that Stephanie's done to see that, you know, we were kind of like, let's see what happens. I mean, we kind of had this idea that, you know, emotional states will change and they'll probably be in a positive way based on, you know, the theory she had read and all the good background work she had done. But we were kind of like, oh, wow, look at this. Like when we actually got the data, we were like, oh, wow, look at this difference between what men and women. That wasn't something we were originally thinking about. And so I would say just that element of empowerment, I imagine, might be stronger for women as being on the side of the oppressed, if I can say it that way, from the beginning of time. And then, sorry, I mean, I'm just, you know, I do some work in feminist stuff too, so I'm a little bit strong on that stuff. And then for men, just not being encouraged to actually emote might be, again, part of the reasoning and why that was maybe more of a muted. And of course, we, you know, we're just speculating now. So as Stephanie was saying, like the next studies to run would be to kind of dig into some of this aspect. I think that would be really interesting.
And to kind of add on to that, something that I would like to include is that a lot of the women I tattoo, they kind of almost do it in a sense to reclaim their body. Mm. I do a lot of tattoos on women in which I probably cannot tell their story here, but being able to reclaim your body as a female, being told your whole life you need to protect yourself from this thing that could happen to you and it will probably be blamed on you, to come into a chair, be completely susceptible to what I put them through and to walk out happy, mm-hmm. I think is also like a big deal. It's a big deal. So, I mean, maybe they're able to express that, you know, better. I'm not really sure. And I think Rachel would know more about that than I would, but it is something that I've been like, oh, like, yeah, this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, do you have any other questions?
I mean, I have a million questions, but we're at 15 minutes now, so we got to give the room up.
Time.
It's 2:57.
So no, I so appreciate, and I mean, like, normally we'd ask about methodology and stuff. I'm so happy you were able to kind of answer my question from your panel, or from your presentation. No, so this is very fascinating. I almost want to ask you to like come back on and talk to us for like an hour.
I would love to. That would be awesome. No.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think set it up. Absolutely.
Let's do it. We'll reach out to you once we're done in RMPA and let's okay. do this longer, because I'm so fascinated about it, because like I understand the reasons of like white people tattoo. I have a cousin who's a tattoo artist.
Perfect.
And like I am like so fascinated by that world, but like it's just, I know it's not for me, but there's just so many things. I mean, I know it could be for me.
Well, and but, there's so many sides to the world too, because we're only talking about client side. There's also artist side that I haven't even touched on, and I could tell you some trauma stories. Well,
then let's do that. Let's cut our interview off here. So thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you for having
and
us.
we will pick up this conversation mm-hmm. at a later date.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks for calling me in, you guys. Happy to join in.
Yeah,
thank you.
Joel.
Okay, have a good day, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.